So I welcome you to this talk this morning. What we're going to be discussing is designing for Ajax or designing for rich internet applications. A lot of times the title Ajax is always put into a talk because it seems sexier, right? But what we're going to find out from the talk today is a lot of things that you know from the desktop world and a lot of things you know from just other interaction areas apply directly into this web space. The talk this morning will be decidedly biased towards web examples. Being at Yahoo, that biases me a little bit that way. But I have a strong background in both desktop and web, which I'll discuss with you. So I kind of got started in the world of interaction design doing a game back in 1985 called Gato. It's a submarine simulation for the Macintosh, one of the first games, kind of big games that came out for the Mac. And I'd never done a game before, and I'd never done a game on a windowing menus icon kind of mouse system, right? So it was kind of an interesting thing to take this new technology and take all these games that I'd been playing, you know, and kind of think about how do you actually design something into the space and take advantage of windows and, you know, menus and all those sort of things. It turned out to be a very freeing experience because with all those new technologies, you could bring those in, and of course there was a nice toolkit. Those days it seemed like a nice toolkit. Today's standards would be pretty puny. But there were a lot of things that were already kind of built for you, and you could sort of get a leg up. And the whole exercise of moving into bringing a game into that space is not unlike today bringing rich interaction into the web, because there's some things you have to sort of think about. You know, if you're going to create, a mission editor in this example, with submarine simulation, you're creating missions. How would you do that? You know, do you use drag and drop, point and click? You know, all those different options just sort of open up to you that you didn't have before. That was a lot harder to do. Before I came to Yahoo, I did an open source framework called Rico, which is at openrico.org, and it was one of the early Ajax frameworks. And I was working at Sabre, and at Sabre, we had this large web framework that I was building with my team. And I got the green light to basically take the whole thing and roll it out open source. We got the first few components out, and then I got hired by Yahoo, as well as the other guy who was working on it and the other guy who was working on it. So Rico sort of went into stasis. Another guy's been working on it, but it's sort of has stayed pretty much where it's at when we left it in 2005. After being at Yahoo a little while, I was exploring this whole thing of interaction and writing a lot of patterns in our internal pattern library, so it sort of seemed like a natural transition for me to also take over the pattern library, and which I did for a while, and I pushed a public version of the pattern library out, which is at developer.yahoo.com/ypatterns. You'll see a link in just a second to that. And the idea was to basically share our thinking at Yahoo about design patterns and what we were thinking internally with the rest of the community and sort of get the rest of the community thinking about patterns. And then I've just recently actually moved out of the Yahoo evangelist role, Ajax evangelist role, into leading the engineering for a new product called Yahoo Teachers, teachers.yahoo.com, which will be coming out this summer. And I created a tool called the Gobbler, which is the Yahoo Gobbler, which basically allows you to kind of rip things off a page and allows teachers to share knowledge collections around the world, as well as any educators to share those things in sort of a Web 2.0 fashion. So that's the pattern library if you're curious to go look at it. A great guy, Christian Crumlish, is now leading that effort, and patterns are being rolled out about once a month now. Not like my infrequent publishing of every 3 to 5 months or so. When I start thinking about patterns, you know, one of the things that gets me excited about it is not so much that, you know, I can give you a style guideline and tell you exactly how to do something. But it's really about thinking about a vocabulary, a shared kind of communication space. There's a lot of interactions that sort of happen at a very micro level. And unless we have a kind of a way to think about it or talk about it between design and engineering, and that's where I like to live. You notice I have both bands on my arm because I've led user experience teams and built user experience teams. And right now I'm leading an engineering team. And so I live in both spaces, and I'm kind of interested in that intersection between design and engineering and how they communicate. And one of those ways is through patterns and really surfacing a vocabulary. And there's a lady named Robin Williams who wrote a book called The Non-Designer's Design Book. And in that book she talks about going home for Christmas and visiting her parents. And they gave her a tree identification book. And in this book, The first thing she came to through her little, branching logic going through the book was a Joshua tree, this guy right here. And it's a really unique looking tree. And she thought, I wonder if there's any trees like that out in the back, So she goes outside and looks in the backyard, and they're everywhere. And she goes around the neighborhood, and they're all over the place. And up to that point, she had never even noticed a Joshua tree living in Southern California. Just had not been her whole thinking at all. But by having a name for it matched to what it looked like, she could then identify it every time she saw it. And that's really the idea of this talk, is we're going to look at a lot of very simple things, some very simple principles that most of you probably already know. I'm going to restate them for you. I'm going to show you lots of examples. And I hope what you walk out with is kind of a deeper vocabulary to talk about those interactions between design and engineering. That's the goal of today. So the current pattern set has about 30 or so, maybe 40 patterns in the YEL library. When I was actually putting the first list together, this is sort of a master list that I was coming up with. Some of these terms come from other folks in the pattern space. Some come from just my own thinking, probably stolen from somewhere else. I don't even realize that we're stolen from. But I just had to have a way to kind of speak about it. And you'll see a lot of these illustrated today. Just to get everybody on the same page, we're talking about the web. And, the classic model on the web is this whole HTTP request. You make the request, the page goes away. And I stop there on purpose because the page goes away. And when you have that happen for 10 years, that kind of model, what develops? A whole eco-space comes around that, right? You start finding out ways to make money around that on page impressions, right? You find that, I can actually do design in such a way that I can create wireframes. We never did that in the desktop world. It didn't work because you didn't have those chunks, right? You start in engineering thinking about session management and cookie management and Earl rewriting and all these goofy techniques to basically allow the application to have some sort of persistent state, because you're dealing in a stateless environment. And I could go and list maybe 10 or 15 things. In fact, in the evangelism team, one of the things I did going around to different teams within Yahoo, talking to them to help them over their hurdles, was look at about 15 different checklist areas like accessibility and et cetera, that this actually impacts by changing that model. And of course the page does come back, and sometimes obviously it takes that long for the page to come back, which is a shame. In the new model, what you have is basically you can do things like an inline editing, as illustrated in this example, and use something called the XML HTTP request object, which we lovingly call XHR, which is almost as hard to say as XML HTTP request, but it is an acronym, and we love acronyms. And the beautiful thing about the XHR or any of the AJAX technologies is it allows you to do something in page without refreshing the page and simulate more of that kind of interaction that you're used to in the desktop. So when I think about this whole area, it really gets into how rich is the interaction. We talked about rich internet applications. What does it mean to be rich? And the way I've thought about it is really in these three dimensions here: interaction, the user interacting with the application or site, the feedback that the system of the application or site's giving back, and the actual information or data that you're dealing with. This is just the traditional model view controller architecture, if you are from the engineering background, recognize that. With information, what happens in the classic model is that you get this very stale snapshot of what the user is thinking or working on. And what users really want in a rich environment is relevancy. They really want a pipeline of relevancy, things flowing into the page that's relevant to what they're doing and how they're interacting at the moment. And that means you have to really understand the business model or the data model. And one of the things that I think is kind of cool in watching some of the Silverlight stuff and with the expression was the fact that it's very easy to create data models and do the binding to those. And that kind of programming is the right kind of programming, because it's basically a model view controller kind of architecture. And it allows you basically to have this thing you're working with and have many, many views to it. So in the web world, the classic world, what we did was we got this snapshot and we got this very, very small, stale representation of your data. But by bringing that data in, you could then take those techniques that have been around in DHTML or other technologies, Flash, whatever, you could take those technologies and start using them. Because before, if you did drag and drop in the page, well, you could do drag and drop, right? But it didn't really mean anything. I mean, you could store some hidden fields on the page, and you could do a submit and those sort of things. But a very clunky interface to do a bunch of drag and dropping and then do a submit, right? It just doesn't make sense. So with this sort of technology now, you can do those kind of interactions. So we'll break the talk into basically these three areas: interaction, feedback, and information. And we'll look at some principles, design principles, that illustrate each of those three areas. And we'll show you a lot of patterns and different examples around the web that illustrate those principles. So the first one's interaction. And again, these are very, very simple, okay? The first one is just about making it direct. And this is what Alan Cooper, who wrote who basically is the father of Visual Basic, he said, wherever there is output, let there be input. And that's a very simple principle, but so often what we do on the web is we have some sort of, you know, profile that we show them, or some kind of a page we show them. And to edit, you have to go to another page to do it. Now, there are problems that get introduced with direct manipulation we'll talk about in just a minute. But this sort of thing of interacting directly with the page is a different model than what we're used to. And Netflix was one of the early ones to do this back in about 2000. And this is a more current version of it, where you have the star rating. And this is basically just the in-page action, where you give somebody the ability to do some sort of action right there in the page directly. A real simple technique. There are oodles and oodles of these now. Portal sites, we have it on our MyYahoo, that you can actually drag the portals around and rearrange what you have. And that's really like a drag and drop modules pattern. Flickr incorporates this organizer concept in kind of a scratch pad area or work pad area that you can drag things up into and then begin to operate on them. It's sort of like a different selection mechanism, if you will. Inline editing. This is off our prior bookmark product, which is MyWeb, which has been replaced by bookmarks. But you could take the bookmark and actually do inline editing right there in place. And this is a traditional example of inline editing from Flickr, where I just click on the text and I get sort of a form that inserts itself right into the area, inline editing. These tools here, these are in-context tools. So in this case, in Flickr, I'm hovering over my buddy's icon, and I'm getting a drop-down affordance that shows on the hover, which tells me, because I see the drop-down, I know I can interact with it. When I do, I get a number of tools that allow me to send a message, or if this person's not one of my buddies, add them as a buddy. And what you're doing is you're bringing a set of tools to the object itself. That's a little bit different, just kind of inverted from selecting something and then operating on it. In this case, you're basically, the tool is coming right to the object. Another example is with Backpacket 37 Signals web product. When you hover over one of your to-do items, you get an in-context tool that's just right there in line with it. In this case, a checkbox and a trash icon. One for deleting, obviously, the other for editing. So some of the things to think about when you're doing inline direct manipulation is inline editing is one of those things that you can bring into the mix that really helps as far as interaction and shortens the cycle of what the user has to do to change things. This example again from Flickr, you know, where I'm under a title and I'm actually clicking and I get this save or cancel. And the inline forms, you know, I would say use those wherever possible because they really do shorten the cycle. Same thing here with our MyWeb I was showing you earlier. Another example here is where you basically have a pop-up. We'll talk about pop-ups and inline stuff in just a few slides later, so I'll leave that for a later discussion. In-context tools, really they're exactly the same as, this is a very old shot of when it was Office 12, you know, the Vista Office. But the ribbon bar concept or the right-click menu, all these things are really contextual sort of menus. You know, the ribbon bar is basically, you know, I'm working with an object and things are coming into context at a certain part of the bar that I can then operate, you know, on that object. A right-click menu is a very simplified version of that and the earliest version of that, right, where you could right-click on an object or a set of objects and get some kind of tools that are in context to that object or objects. In the case of the web, what we have is really a single object that you're operating on. And you have to really remember that because so a lot of times what people will do is they'll start adding the in-context tools, and you really need to, what they're not thinking about is the scale that's going to happen. You know, they've got two or three things in their prototype, but what if you have 50? You know, how are you going to delete all of them? Sometimes you add a different interaction for that, but you have to kind of think about that kind of mechanism. For example, if you have a whole palette of photos, do you use a selection mechanism instead, where you can actually select those objects and then have a tool that you say delete, versus having the in-context tools? And sometimes people will try to mix the two, and you get sort of a weird, you know, a situation happening. And this is, again, that buddy icon showing you it's exactly the same thing. I'm operating on one person. I'm doing the command on that. One thing to think about is that it's good for only a single object, but it's also something that can actually can slow you down. Let me just do this first, though. This is from our teacher product when you're actually have images and stuff you've collected in your project, in your portfolio. We have this hover. Now, we're changing this because one of the problems, and this is a classic kind of hover and cover problem, right, where what's happening is it's actually the in-context tool is kind of big, and it's taking over the next space. So something as simple as this, you know, we tend to move left or right, west, and so when you're moving left or right with your mouse, you're covering over the next thing, right? So do you do it where it goes down? Do you make it more compact? And those are some things we're exploring on the ways to do that, but that's kind of a classic problem that happens. And then there's also the how much do you do actually on a hover sort of thing like that. And we'll talk about that when we talk about invitations. But if you notice, Google's approach generally has been to not do anything on hover, but do it on click. That's changing a good bit as they introduce more applications, like the Google Docs stuff and a number of other tools. You'll see hover starting to creep in because it's really hard to have a lot of deep interaction just on click. So hover becomes a nice tool to expose things, but then you run into this problem here. But it does give you a way to have direct manipulation of these images directly. Now, here's what happens with 37 signals if I do a bunch of editing really fast. I do two things, open them up, I click two things, I make changes here, do save change twice. Only one of them got saved. Now, that's probably an engineering problem. But it's one of those things that you have to think about. Also here, when you go click, 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 some of them come back from the dead. You know, I actually did take care of the bread. No, I didn't take care of the bread. You know, it comes back and forth. And the reason that's happening is because the use case they're trying to exploit here is that you're checking one thing at a time. You're coming back and only a couple of things have changed. I'm not that kind of person, okay? What I do is I forget I have this to-do list. And then I remember and I go, oh, yeah, I should go check that, my to-do list. And I got like 10 things to check off, right? I don't know if you're like that, but I'm definitely like that. So I need a to-do to remind me that I have a to-do list. But so I go back to the to-do list, and I start click, 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 click. Some of them are coming back from the dead, you know. The thing is I'm having to wait for Ajax, this wonderful fast manipulation, right? Whereas it might have been simpler just to have check, 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 and say, yeah, I'm done. Now, if that's not the normal use case, though, this is the right way to do it. So I'm not going to tell you that that's the best way to find out in these sort of situations. It's the user testing or know who your users are and what their use case or workflow is. In design, we always like to say it depends, right? And it does. So drag and drop is another one of those direct manipulation that people get really all excited about and start using it everywhere and find that they kind of make the user more confused than they were to begin with. Here's an example. Somebody got excited about drag and drop and said, oh, I can rate DVDs like this. So I can have DVDs kind of slide in from the, they're supposed to, I think, slide in from the right-hand side. And then what you do is you drag them into the buckets and say, I loved it, I loathed it, I liked it, or whatever the different alliterations are there. Now, the problem with this is that there's a much simpler way to do it. Just click a star, right? I don't have to target drag, target drop to do something. This is one of those times when we do artificial things, and you can always kind of tell when you're doing something artificial with drag and drop is when you start creating a visual space just to support drag and drop. When you start creating a visual metaphor just to support your technology, you know you've gone down the wrong path, right? What you want to do is if the normal metaphor, visual metaphor, is something that has containment or, you know, it's a list of things, those sort of things, they're perfect for drag and drop as a shortcut to add in the interface. But it's not something to go create, you know, these actual buckets and take up all this extra real estate. This was the next one here, I think. This won the Flex Award for the best, second best concept, you know, blah, 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 last year, whatever. It's terrible. I mean, what you're doing is you're basically not only has bugs too, but what's happening is the way I'm saying these are favorite real estate locations is I'm taking those, dragging those down into something in the bottom, and that puts a heart by it. Why can't I just click it and put a heart by it, right? I mean, Google Gmail did this a long time ago. The little star is just real simple. You just click the thing, right? But, you know, again, we get all these wonderful little tools. And I'll tell you what's going to happen with Silverlight and all this stuff, with all this pan and zoom and zoomable UIs. Because Zooies have been around since sometime the mid-late 80s. There were a number of papers written on zoomable UIs. And they're really a cool thing. But we're going to have this pan and zoom crap that's just going to drive people nuts. So be careful about the, yeah, good. Thank you. And I watched this with the whole Ajax thing, is basically a number of these things. We get to talk about transitions in a little bit. We tend to start focusing on these special effects instead of what the purpose is. The purpose is, just like creating a movie, if you had a movie, just the whole goal was to have special effects. It's kind of cheesy after a while, right? But special effects and these sort of things can really be helpful in communicating what you want to communicate, right? If drag and drop's done right. Here in GTalker, I'm just rearranging, you know, panels. Well, that's a very natural place to add drag and drop, right? There are issues with accessibility and discoverability. But if you know the thing, if you're a little more advanced, you have this thing to your available to you. In a list, in Backpacket, it does a very pedantic thing where it says drag everywhere. But hey, it works. I know to drag it. Maybe it's one of those scaffoldings that we put in to get people kind of used to doing these sort of things. But in a constrained list, you notice what's happening as we're dragging this around. It's kind of ghosting it and moving at the same time. And that works pretty well in a constrained list. What doesn't work well is if you start trying to move something around and you ghost it and you move it at the same time. And this just violates principles that have been around forever on the desktop. And the reason why is because when you're actually making something slightly, you know, transparent and moving it around, you're telling the user that this is experimental. You're not saying this is finished. And you always, in an interface, want to allow users the ability to escape and get out of what they're doing. But when you're moving something around and it's all of a sudden moving with you, that's a little disconcerting. You can get away somewhat with this because it's in a list and it's a constrained area and the chance of making a mistake is a lot less. But generally, it's not a good idea to do that. Interactive Google, when Google first had their interactive Google page, they made the same mistake. I think somewhere I have that video. I need to put it back in this talk. But what they did was, as you move things around, you got sort of this, you got the actual object, didn't even ghost it. And it just, then there was a second one moving around underneath you, right? Very, very confusing. Now, that they have it now where it's pretty nice. They've got basically an insertion spot. And what we did on my Yahoo was basically, as we move things around, we have an insertion bar that shows where it's going to go. And the reason we did that, we didn't want to disturb the page too much, you know, as you move things around. So this is using the gobbler that I was talking about earlier that I created. Basically, you can just rip things right off the page. You can take images, you can take links, you can take text clippings, those sort of things. When I first did this as a kind of a collection tool, you know, for this Yahoo Teachers product, I thought, you know, drag and drop, this is kind of, it'll be fun to put in there initially. It's the quickest thing to do, but I'm going to take that out because it's not the most efficient way to do it. But the teachers actually loved it. And it's funny, as I've talked to lots of people using this tool, it's sort of this satisfaction of going to any web page and just being able to just grab something and rip it right off and drop it into your bucket and it's saved without adding any special tags or other crap, because the tags are already associated with the project, so everything gets washed with those tags, right? This simple little hand motion says, I did it, I did it, I did it. So we've, at this point, continue to keep it in the tool, even though I can imagine other things where you just hover over something and you got an in-context tool and you say, add it to this project, those sort of things. But this, you know, once they know to do this, and we have a video to show them to do that, they just take off like a rocket with it. With my Yahoo, we had several incarnations. One was this thing where you can do the list to move modules around. The nice thing about this is that it is, you can make this fully accessible, although most of the time that would just be for low vision folks and other people like that, and not for the non-sighted, because they don't need to worry about the arrangement except in the sense of the screen reader, what order it's going to read it in. So they don't need really an XY sort of thing. This was an in-between thing before drag and drop showed up on the site, where you had this odd thing where you have a right click and you can move the modules around, and then the module moves with the right click menu, kind of a bizarre thing, and then finally we ended up with actually being able to just move things around on the page. So following on the heels of this, with this direct manipulation, is keeping a light footprint. And this is really kind of how you go about doing this. And the poster child for this is dig.com, if you've seen dig.com. And what Dig does is allow you to, originally it was tech articles, now it's any kind of news articles. If you dig something, you can put it up, and it starts showing up on the home page, the main page, is something to dig, and other people see it, and they say, oh, I dig this. And when you click the dig button, you've cast your single vote for that item, and then you get back a number showing how many other people, in between the time you refresh the page and you voted, how many other people have actually voted on this. Kevin Rose, who did this, he was actually at Tech TV, and he was doing the Screensavers program. He was one of the tech geek on that show. He did this sort of as a social experiment to see what would happen if you could allow people to say what they thought was interesting. And obviously, there's a lot of fun stuff around that now with gaming, Dig, and all that. But he said when he added this little simple Ajax interaction to do the direct manipulation, it was probably the most important thing early on, probably the single most important thing he did early on to the product that made it successful. So if you do this on your website, you're going to be in the cover of Business Week, just like Kevin Rose, right? Exactly. But no, it was a very important thing for him at the time because it gave him a leg up on the voting mechanism without having to go to another page to do it. You could just a very lightweight, a very light footprint to do this. And if you can remove those pain points, identify those pain points, those stopping points, those bailout moments that users have in your interface, especially in a web interface, then this is one of the ways to do it, is a light footprint, allowing people to interact very lightly. I'm going to skip that one. That's a bad example. This is, remember, collection off the Gap. And basically what they've done is allow you to have, you know, in kind of in-context shopping carts or in-place shopping carts. So you don't really go that far. You know, it's just the impulse aisle, basically in the grocery store, being able to check things out quickly and grab things as you go. And again, rating an object like on Netflix and various other sites or Yahoo Movies. Interesting one, this Yahoo Movies one has a lot of different choices. And it turns out that about half our users really like this and about half really hate it because it has too many choices, right? Paradox of choice. So you'll see a lot of rating systems have gone to just a simple, you know, thumb up or thumb down or whatever. In our teacher product, what we've done is we just have, I can only do a thumbs up. You can't be mean to other teachers, right? That just wouldn't be kosher. And they get apples, right? And the teachers get those when you rate them. So removing the pain points, shortening the path of resistance, you know, through the thing. And what that means is when you start asking yourself those questions, what you start doing is focusing back on the user, right? You start thinking again about the user, not about your technology. And you start thinking about what is it that's stopping my user from getting their main work done. And then you'll be surprised. There's usually some very simple showstoppers somewhere in the path that you can change and remove. Again, Dig. Designing for engagement is one of those things you can do. Over here with the Gap, what's happening is you're getting the color changes, getting a preview of that, and you're able to see the inventory. So the whole interaction feels much lighter in choosing several dimensions of the product. This is this is a classified ad site in the UK, and basically what you can do is come in place there and click each part of the classified ad and begin to fill it out in place. So you don't have this big laborious form. What they've done is they've made the view of it and the actual editing of it be much more similar, which kind of feels a little more lightweight about what you're interacting with. You know how far you are in the process, and you know when you're done. So the next principle that goes along with this this whole thing of interaction is about crossing borders reluctantly. And this is really about the page boundary. And you have to sort of think about it that way, that if you put a page boundary in place, that's a place where users could bail out and decide not to continue in the product. One of the things we did with Yahoo Mail is we have this endless scrolling. So basically you can just scroll through and you get your mail messages and you get the experience that you get like an Outlook or any of the normal mail applications. Google takes a different approach. They have the paging model, and there's pluses and minuses for both. We'll discuss in just a second. Another simple one is just in-context spam, where you reveal information on a click, which avoids going to another page. I showed you the inline assistant a minute ago, and that's a great example of not having the page-to-page-to-page-to-page kind of flow. getting a sneak peek or Hubbard Details, like we do on Yahoo News and a number of other sites. Netflix made this popular to begin with, peeking at the movie. What it does is it raises the level of satisfaction. Jared Spool talks about this thing called the confidence game. And what he did in a study was he found that users, if given a task that may take 10 or 20 different steps, if during those 10 to 20 steps they feel like they're narrowing down on the answer, they report a good user experience, a happy experience. Because the brain loves that sort of, you know, puzzle solving that's getting rewarded that you're narrowing down. Now, you wouldn't want to have your users do those 15 to 20 steps every day. They're not going to report the same experience, right? But if you can actually, you know, let users kind of look ahead of time and know the path they're going to get to is going to be most likely satisfactory, because that's relevance, right? Then what you're going to do is you're going to make people happier with your site. And even though they may click less initially, they're going to come back more often. And that was kind of the bet we did with Yahoo News and those. Because we changed one thing like that, we could really affect, you know, how many page impressions and those sort of things. And this actually did work. We had more news coverage. Same thing with our homepage. With adding a lot of the Ajax stuff onto the page, it actually increased traffic throughout the whole network dramatically because of exposing things in a very simple way. That's another where you can see a chart in line, you know, lightweight pop-ups, those sort of things that you can now do on the web. And it's really about the user's mental model and not the page model. And remembering that every page, you know, jump is just a mental speed bump, you know, for the user. It doesn't mean that page boundaries are bad. For example, if you're doing an install process, page is a lot of times very, very good. You're collecting information. Sometimes you want to make it in three easy steps, and you want to chunk that up into steps, right? So sometimes it makes sense to chunk things up. Sometimes it doesn't, depending on what you're trying to do. A lot of times it depends on how motivated the person is to go through the process. And then on paging versus scrolling, this is just a typical real estate site where I'm, you know, going next, and seeing five items at a time. A couple of years back, I was playing with a Yahoo search APIs and with the Ricoh library, and I built just a live grid thing that you could endlessly scroll through search results. And the idea was just to really kind of talk about endless scrolling and live scrolling in the web, having your paging model kind of, you know, being really kind of hidden behind a scroll bar in essence, because you're pulling things in dynamically. It turns out that search is not the best place to do that. I know Microsoft Live went at one point live with a scroll bar on their search, and I was talking to Scott Isaacs at another event, and we were chatting about the whole thing, and his answer to me on why that was actually pulled was because of scalability issues. And because, you know, when you start actually scrolling through search results, you're hammering the servers a lot more. We had this exact same experience at Yahoo. I'll show you in just a second. There are other ways to sort of have a hybrid between the two. You know, carousels have gotten to be more popular. I even wrote a carousel component for the YUI library that's going to be part of it shortly. And we use it on our teacher product. And they're pretty useful to show things that are very relevant up front and then bring in things that are less relevant. They go down pretty fast, so you don't have to go very far into it. They're not really good for displaying huge lists of things, right? They're good for showcasing a few items and kind of tickling you to get to more items. I just was experimenting with different things where you can have a tab sort of thing and actually make it sort of scroll, or you could have a news module. These are just little prototypes that I'd done a year or so back, where you're actually moving through and pulling the information in. You don't have to, like, say, I'm not limited to the fact that I have five items, news items showing on my homepage. I can just kind of roll through them. Man, it's still a paging model, this bottom one. It's just paging stuff in, but it's doing it in an animated kind of scroll fashion. So it's sort of a hybrid between the two. And I'll say one more thing about that. When you have data that the user feels like they own, and what I mean by that is, they're going to manipulate the view of it, sort it, go through it. It's something they work with all the time. The scrolling model seems to work much better than a paging model in that regard, if you can handle it from an architecture scalability perspective. That's just because, you know, the whole action of doing that. Another thing to consider, too, that I don't actually have in this talk, but in another talk I do, is with selection. One of the things that happens is when you have scrolling, direct selection, where you select the item and usually get like the blue highlight or whatever. That sort of selection model works really good in a scrolled environment, whereas the checkbox model and then hit a button works really good in the paging, because users expect when I go check, 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 I go to the next page, that stuff's probably gone because I've sort of refreshed the page, right? And you'll notice that in Gmail, the way it does it is you go check, 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 check. If you go to the next page, nothing's selected anymore. If those things aren't still selected on the previous page, it wouldn't make sense for them to do that. But with a scrolling model, you sort of know that it's up there, down there, right? You've got this continuous flow, and so you have a different selection model. I don't have a shot of it, but the latest version of our Yahoo Mail application now combines checkbox and selection together, which I wasn't quite sure could be done correctly. And except for one little tiny thing, I think they've really done a great job on it. Because sometimes you want to be able to go, especially in mail, you want to go check, 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 check. You don't want it to load in the read pane, like for spam and stuff like that. So you have the satisfaction of just hitting the checkbox, and it selects it but doesn't read it. And so you can go check. The first one, spam, doesn't show in the read pane. Thank you very much. Check, 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 check. Mark them all as spam. Check, 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 check. Mark them all as delete. Or you can go, yeah, I want this, 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 and this, and you can still do either model. So that kind of works pretty well. Overlays, you know, are for when I'm wanting to give that peak kind of thing I was talking about, but I want to give more information, and it avoids me having to go to another page to see if I really want that information or not. Again, this is Netflix has this add to queue, which is an overlay that comes on top. You can see the other stuff is kind of masked out with a kind of a light box effect, where the top part has sort of a light on it. And what this did for them was they noticed their users were basically, they would say add to queue, and then they would offer a bunch of other suggestions. And they go, oh, that looks good too, and they'd go down that path. And then they'd be frustrated because they really wanted to start back at their main branch, right? So by doing this sort of thing, it allows this additional second level to come up, and they can still navigate in that. And when they get done, they can close it and be back to where they started when they started down the path. And users reported from their testing that to be a very successful way to do it. I'll skip this one for the sake of time. So this is a bad example from our Yahoo Photos. I do like to pick on Yahoo. So that's okay there, but notice something happens. They have a pop-up. They have dancing hamsters. And they have a pop-up. And you'll get to see this a few times, so if you want to take a picture of the dancing hamsters, go for it. The thing here is, this is what we call idiot boxes, okay? I'm dropping three items into the folder, and what do we do wrong there? Yeah, you can't see this going in the folder. We could highlight the folder, right? If we highlight the folder, we don't need to have a message that says, duh, you dropped it into a folder, right? They would just know it implicitly from that. We could also show the number of items that are in the folder, and that increments at the end of it, so you don't have to have a pop-up at the end that says you actually did drop three items that you think you dropped into the folder. They really did go in there, by the way. Those are called idiot boxes. And what has happened, because it's easier to create these little lightweight boxes, then people kind of went crazy with them and started putting them everywhere, right? Which is what we did in the desktop world for a long time. Just like your zoomable UIs, your pan and zoom, people can do it now, so people go crazy with it for a while until they find it, you know, the right way to use it. It's always that way. So, you know, in context expands versus those pop-ups, they're really good for like contextual stuff. If I have a list of things and I want to edit something in context, the rest of the things, I'd like to be able to see what else is in the list. So the in context expand works really good there versus the pop-up overlay, which would hide information. So different examples. So I can sum that up by saying prefer direct, lightweight, in page interaction. All that, everything I just said, blah, right? It's pretty simple, just real simple. And the next principles go really fast, so we will finish on time. Live feedback is a very important thing, because now we're getting the stuff back from the interface. And this example from our Yahoo Answers, which has turned out to be a very successful product. What we're doing there is when they type the question, we're showing them other questions that match this question. And one thing is to try to limit the number of times people ask, why is the sky blue? And those sort of things. To get a set of questions in our database of questions and have to do less work in matching those. But another is to actually provide the user with a good answer. So we're kind of satisfying two needs at once, a system need and the user need. Autocomplete, obviously, is something that we see more commonly. Kayak, for the longest time, has done it right when most people have not, in that when you do the autocomplete and you actually match whatever it is, it highlights what you match. If you just tab out of it, it actually takes what that thing is instead of you having to use the arrow key to go down to it. It's so annoying when you have those. MarketWatch has this thing of periodic refresh. We do the same thing on Yahoo Finance now, where you can get live streaming quotes and you're seeing it update. This could be disconcerting. So kind of the jury's out on how useful this is. I think if you have a lot of text on the page, perhaps it's pretty annoying. What we've done is in our Yahoo Finance, we have a smaller area that's just the quote itself, and you're seeing things change every four or five seconds, whatever it is. So you're seeing the trend of the market by doing that, which is kind of an interesting thing to do. But in this case, I'm not sure if this is good because you have all this text, and it sort of can be, you're kind of reading instead of just looking at something that's actually a dashboard, if you will. Busy indicators, basically showing you that something's happening right there in context where you're at. Being able to search like on small business for a domain and getting the response right back there on the page and telling you something's been taken or not and offering you alternates instead of having to go to multiple pages. That kind of feedback is really about error prevention. Now, here's two examples, one from Google, and all of us are probably familiar with Google Suggest. And the idea behind Google Suggest is I start typing something like Ajax, and given the context, it might actually be Ajax, the soccer team, football team in Amsterdam, or it could be Ajax programming, right? So it also could help you with checking your spelling, a few other things. But as it sits just on this page here, it's not the most useful thing for the masses, because the masses are not actually searching for search terms. They're searching for search results, right? Now, you can bind this together, you could get something pretty powerful. And you can see this in the browser bar, where that sort of thing is combined, and it works really well. But the problem with this is that you can actually be more distracting by giving those sort of things back and not really helping narrow down on the actual search result. We did something on the kind of the opposite extreme with Yahoo Instant Search, where when you started typing, you got a bubble that popped up and gave you the one result that matched it. So the problem is it's really from our Yahoo shortcut stuff, which is in essence sort of a curation of the web, trying to find the best content, and that's not always what you're looking for. And it's not really advertising we're pushing at you, just what we think is the best choice for that search term, which means we don't have answers for everything. We have answers only for a small set. So you're narrowing very quickly on a very small band of the long tail, and what ends up happening is, when you don't get this, you go, am I typing the right thing? So you get this really a lot of feedback on one situation and no feedback on the other, and that can be distracting. So the same guy who's actually designed this, realized some of the fallacies of this, and we were working together on another project, and this is something called All the Web, which was supposed to be the new Yahoo Search. And the idea was to take the suggest concept on the left-hand side, so I'm typing Ajax or IX, and I'm getting the list of suggestions on the left-hand side, and that becomes kind of a whole toolbar, if you will, on the left. And then what happens is each one of those becomes a tab into the results. It's kind of a nice interface. In fact, when we did all of our testing and I went to a number of the user studies, it was really unanimous. People really liked this. But why did we not go live with it? The main reason was it would triple the number of servers we needed, right? And we couldn't justify it from a cost perspective, this improved user experience, to triple the number of servers. That's a lot of servers at Yahoo. So just like Microsoft Live, Scott Isaac then dropped the scroll bar out because of scalability issues. So something as subtle as a design change like this can have a huge economic impact, right? And that's something to consider. So one of the cool things about feedback is that you can actually shape user perception. You can make time feel like it goes faster, as we know. The old, Mac way back, just the cursor sitting there, no spinning. That was actually the same amount of time, 4.5 seconds for both of those. But one did feel faster than the other. And we've all kind of seen that work in interfaces. Something to remember, though, when you're giving feedback during a process is that perceived time is very important to the user versus just real time. An ounce of prevention in design is worth a pound of error handling in code, which is a really important thing because it gets to be expensive. So if I'm doing something like here in Google, where I'm changing a password and I'm getting the feedback on the strength of the password ahead of time, that's a really nice thing, right? Same thing I showed earlier with domain search, same sort of thing where you're preventing the errors ahead of time, and it is a lot less interface that has to be created, and actually less design in most cases has to be done for these sort of interfaces to just be smart up front. This is on Land's End, and this is the little guy you get to sort of be you, to dress up. This is a live preview sort of thing, right? Now, when you first get there, you get the guy. He's in his skivvies, thankfully, and you get to sort of put your dimensions in. And if you're like me, you get done with it. And you go, oh my God, do I look like that? Because he gets pretty rotund. And then so then you get to put clothes and stuff like that. Now, what's interesting about this is that this is what we can do with live feedback. You're actually giving the customers, this experience gets better. We're giving the customer a chance to really experience the product ahead of time. And so it's not just, you know, in previewing some little simple thing on the page, but it's actually creating preview models that you can imagine going forward. And with some of the new technology that's been talked about here at the show, obviously more and more of these kind of things are very capable to do and can be something that makes your product stand out and differentiates it. You know, feedback, just simply putting the feedback in proximity to where you're at, you know, where you actually see it, right, where you're working is a very important thing. And that search example down below where it says check mail and compose and all that and go, you could also have put the indication over where the search results are going to come to direct the user's attention, so you can play with either one of those kind of techniques. Or you can just go crazy and you can avail yourself to many different indicators that are out there, and there's some pretty gaudy ones. In fact, this is a very subtle, nuanced thing. This is back from about 3 years ago with Laszlo. What happened when I added something to the cart? You saw a little bump on the right. It said it went into that cart. And then, so it kind of tells you, oh, it went over there, okay. Well, I can actually drag and drop into there, but I can also just click and add it. They have both the in-context tools as well as the drag and drop. But you're getting that little subtle nuance of the bump. Now, this is just the opposite. Don't copy this one. When you do a search, yes, we get Blink. Sweet. We have Ajax plus Blink. I love it. Too much feedback. So another kind of form of this whole thing of feedback is an area of an invitation. And what this really means is about inviting the user beforehand to know what's going to happen. So feedback can a lot of times be about what's already happened, right? But this is more about beforehand, inviting the user to do something. You know, we can clue the user that they have these choices, they hover over it. We can clue them that if they come over this area, they can actually rate it. So we're providing a number of invitations. We can do things like tour invitations like we do on our homepage, where you can go to the 1-2-3 step and it does kind of a light box effect to highlight the areas to show what it's previewing. In this here, we have basically a drop, the nuclear explosion. We have the drop message that's showing up there. And actually, the nuclear explosion, I was talking to Stuart, who's over Flickr, and I said, dude, what's up with the nuclear bomb thing there? And he goes, oh, that one. So, you know, one of the developers just found a great little funny icon, right? It actually turns out to be a very poor choice for a number of reasons. I won't get into the political implications of it, but I'll say that from the perspective of you're not really destroying the thing, right? You're just pulling it out of your work area. So even in something as subtle as that sort of thing, it's important that you're communicating the right message both from a geopolitical perspective as well as from other perspectives. But the point was that you can actually use that space down below to say if you drop here, it's going to do this. You can actually do those sort of things and get away with it. Tooltips, covers, cursors, all those sort of things all play into inviting the user to know what's going to happen, because when you have direct manipulation, one of the problems you run into is the whole thing of discoverability. You know, can you actually do something with this? And what happens over time in any space, any interface space, is certain things are learned as idioms. Idioms are just learned traits. So over time, the user community in the web gets trained to kind of expect to do things, just like, you know, they expect to do rollover. And if you've ever understood what mystery meat navigation is when you kind of, you know, have to open the can up and find out what's actually in the can, right? you're hovering over these different things and finding, oh, that's what that does. You know, a lot of car sites will do that sort of thing because they want you to kind of interact and play with it. You can actually search for Mystery Meat navigation and see a lot of cool things on Mystery Meat. So we don't want that sort of thing. We want to invite people. We want to be kind of clear up front, but then provide the invitation. And there's always this balance between how much do I put in the visual treatment ahead of time statically to let somebody know they can do something versus what do I expose during the interaction phase. And working with our teams in Bangalore, they're working on a product called Our City, which basically mashes up information about most of the major cities in India and provides kind of a portal for them. The thing they were running into was, through their somewhat limited testing at the time, they were seeing that users did not even really get the concept of the hovering. And so they were having to put lots of stuff right in the interface, and it looked busier, but it was much more usable. And over time, what will happen is you can pull some of those scaffolds down, some of those mental frameworks down out of the interface and go back to a more subtle interaction. But that'll take some time, and it's different depending on the community of users that you have. So we talked a lot about this discoverability. You can't flag everything. You can't turn like a backpack it into something like this where everything has an edit link and a trash can. You could do that. But you definitely have to take the fonts down. You have to do a bunch of things to make the visual treatment less heavy if you had to do something like that. And a lot of the key to this is actually taking some of the bridging the new with the old. And what I mean by that is basically you're taking the things that are familiar to the user and the space they're in, and you're bringing them to the next level to a newer, a deeper interaction. So, for example, taking hyperlinks, when I hover over things, I'm getting some tools that show up that I can work with. Drop-down clues, hover effects, all those sort of things. Like when I get this guy, I get the drop-down. Most people know what to do when they see a arrow pointing down. They know it's probably like a select box or a combo box. They know to click on it. So you're taking familiar things, and it's still, for example, I mean, in a lot of cases, it's still like a right-click menu, right? But you just visually treated it different to fit within the scheme of what people are used to, bridging the gap. And, making and inviting, all those sort of things. We'll skip through this. One of the things you want to probably do on invitations and hover and stuff like that is really try to keep actions out of it. This, I think, is a bad example from Yahoo, and I've complained loudly about this over a number of times to the team, but they ignore me. When you hover over this, what happens is it grows out and covers, a lot of the content. The bad thing is that there's three different forms of local. That one has the map here, one has the map here, and one has the map here. I can understand two of them. I don't understand three of them. But anyway, this one that has it on the left, it does that. The one that has it on the right doesn't do that. So you're inconsistent there. But the big thing is that you really don't want to make the user afraid to move the mouse around, right? So you want to try to be careful. It's kind of like I was showing you back on our teacher site with that hover and cover kind of problem. We need to solve that because we don't want to be annoying every time you move your mouse around, things are popping up. At the same time, we want to invite them, give them the actions they need when they're doing it. Amazon has this thing where basically you put it on your blog, and when you hover over it, you get the zoom out box that's advertising the book. And the problem there is that to get rid of it, then you have to target the close box. So it came up very easily just on a hover, but you have to go to this extreme length to close it. Now, from a merchandising perspective, it probably makes perfect sense. From a user experience perspective, it's very annoying because it's not symmetric. It's not symmetrical about how it was activated and how it gets deactivated. You have to go to some length to get rid of it. And again, it might make sense from a merchandising perspective and might be successful from that perspective, but not from a user experience. So this next principle is around showing transitions, and this is about cinematic effects. And you're going to, obviously, say with Silverlight, you can expand this even to the zoomable UIs and kind of take the same principles. Fading, like there, I deleted something, it faded out, and the gap closed up, sort of a self-healing transition. Moving through a carousel like this in Photos gives me a time-based thing. I know I'm going forward in time or backward in time, which is really useful. Here in Flickr, I'm dragging stuff up. I'm getting sort of this status area that's showing, that's telling me what's happened, and those things fade out over time. Zoom box is one that's not real common, but Amazon uses, that's Gap, to kind of show that it came from that, although I think the association is probably tight enough that you don't have to have it since the image is going to give you the confirmation. But it is something, if you have a looser association between that which you've activated and that which you show, you might want to have a zoom box. There's a great book called Mind Hacks that O'Reilly puts out, Tom Stafford and Matt Webb. Matt Webb gives a number of talks, and they're always entertaining. And he has a few hacks in there about attention processing. And it's basically a book that really has 100 hacks in it. It talks about to help you kind of understand how your brain works. There's a number of optical illusions and various things like that. They're all real short things you can kind of do in self-experiments. In the area of attention processing, he talks about that, you know, our brain is processing visual information in numbers of ways. One of the ways is through the visual cortex, and we have sight. Another is the fact that when objects are moving rapidly or things are changing, color rapidly, those sort of things also get routed to a different part of the brain that processes that. And you can have a phenomenon called blindsidedness where an individual doesn't have the visual cortex part working, appear to be blind, but have the other part working that's processing the attention. And so they can actually know that something is coming at them or a light's being shined in a certain area, but they don't really see it, but they sort of have that sensation. And that's exactly what's happening chemically in your brain every time you see advertising and the dancing mortgage ads, you know, the guys who are in the shadows that do that sort of thing. You can't help but look at them, even though you want to kill them, right? They draw your attention because chemically your brain is saying, look out, saber-toothed tiger coming out of the rocks and you're about to be eaten, right? It's just a primal response that you just cannot help to do. So knowing that we have this chemistry in our brain, we can actually play on this and use it correctly to communicate versus abuse our users. And this is the Flickr zeitgeist, which you can put in your blog. And if you look over away from it to the middle of the screen, you'll see that something's happened in your peripheral vision. And you'll glance over at it to see what happened. But the thing that actually moved, you sort of miss and go, what did I miss? But what they're really trying to draw you to is what just faded in. So in a sense, what happens is you think you missed what they wanted you to see, but in fact, you saw what they wanted you to see, but you didn't know it, which is kind of confusing, right? Now, once you know what's going on there, it's not a big deal, right? But perhaps this is the opposite message, and this is an example from Matt's talk. Matt also gives another example of from the Apple desktop. You know, you have the widgets that come up in their own layer, which is kind of an odd thing. And then they go like that. They fly at you when you put them away, right? Which seems a little odd that they're flying away into space somewhere instead of being put away. Now, again, it's not anything earth-shattering. If that's the effect you want, that's great. And maybe that's what Apple did it on purpose and went to, right? But the thing is we have to realize is that each of these kind of transitions communicate something. You know, a rapid movement takes precedent over a slow movement. A quick color change is less than movement, but greater than a slow color change. And there's sort of a hierarchy of those sort of things. And if you think about those in that sort of way, you can apply those where you need them in the interface and apply them sparingly. Because with every one of these kind of things, you have a limited amount of bandwidth. You have a limited amount of color bandwidth, you know, attention bandwidth, all those sort of things. And you need to kind of judiciously use those in the interface. They're at the right places and not overload user unless it's in a game or something that has more of an entertainment value to it. So again, with transitions, you can speed up time like we talked about a little bit earlier. But you can also slow down interaction, which means that when you go to accomplish something, you can actually let the user see what happened. Things slide into place. And that's actually slowing down interaction. You can also show state change, like I'm deleting something, it fades out, it closes the hole, those sort of things. You can also show relationships, like we were talking about, between objects by the zoom box, for example. Or you can focus the attention by spotlighting something and fading it out. There's a number of other things you can do with this, but that's just some of the messaging you can do with transitions or animated cinematic effects. They turn out to be pretty powerful. Now, one of the things, I was talking to a motion graphics guy down in L.A., and he was telling me a principle he uses in setting luminance and other values when he's cutting commercials and stuff, is he gets the effect just like he thinks it should be, but then he always cuts it in half. And that's a really good principle to use on most of the stuff you're doing right now with the new things you can do, say in Silverlight, for example, is you want to try to not focus so much on that effect, but kind of step back and look at the overall picture. And one of the ways you can do that is by cutting your transitions and stuff in half, you know, from what you kind of think it should be. When we first did My Yahoo, you'll notice that we sort of had an exaggerated effect where things kind of slid in, moved around slow. And over time, and I wasn't even actually talking to the team, I was talking about this phenomenon, but I noticed that they actually sped it up through user testing and other things and got it to going faster. You don't need a lot. The brain can fill in the gaps. Just need a little hint to it. So providing invitations beforehand, transitions during, and feedback after interaction, really this set of principles. And the last stuff, I'll wrap up real quick here, is thinking in objects. And this is a pretty powerful thing because so often on the web we think about just content. And in the desktop world, obviously, with user applications, we tend to have a little more model-oriented perspective or data-oriented perspective. But bringing that into the web is something that makes web applications more powerful. This is a simple product called Trip Planner. It's on our site, Yahoo Trip Planner. And what it does is allows you to create trip itineraries. And then what happens is those can be found through a developer API. They can be searched. They can be exposed through our search technologies. And then you can find one of those things. You can clone it, and you can make your own. And we do the same thing with our teachers.yahoo.com product in that what we do is allow a teacher to set up something on Mitosis, for example, and then go out and gobble content around that and then create whiteboards or lesson plans around those and share those with anybody in the world. And by turning those into objects, something that's actually searchable through a search API so other people can mash it up any way they want to, or you can expose it through our search interfaces, those sort of things, you make something have a life of its own way beyond just being on the page, which is a pretty powerful concept. And here's just examples of that being surfaced, trip plans on Yosemite. You know, go take one of those and go, oh, wow, when I go to Yosemite, this is what I'm going to do, and clone those things and delete what you don't want to do. Flickr did this because, photos are being treated more like objects, and they can be put onto a map and geocoded, if they're not automatically geocoded. When Flickr added this interface within a period of, 24 hours, I think there was, 10 million or 12 million photos that got geotagged, which is a pretty large number of people dragging and dropping images. It's a lot of dragging and dropping. So another strong principle is tying information to interactivity. And this is, you'll see this in Google Finance. I should show the news stuff on the right-hand side. What's happening is you're trying to see correlations between different events in the stock cycle and the price cycle and seeing how it correlates to different news events. Our Yahoo Finance adds a number of things like this whole concept of focus plus context so that you have a focus up there and you have the context of everything here, and then even inside this you can put a focus within the context of the five-year chart. And from a kind of analysis, financial analysis perspective, these kind of tools, add a lot, and that's what we're trying to cater to in the Yahoo Finance. Is we have a set of advanced finance tools that folks can use to analyze the stock market. This is a cool product called Faircast, faircast.com, and what it does is it gives you all these different visualizations of a different market, flight market. So say San Jose to say Dallas, you can see historically what the prices have been. You can also, it has predictor algorithms, says this is a good time to buy or not a good time to buy. And you can play with stuff like the length stay and all those sort of things. And that sort of visualization, tying that sort of information, deeper interaction like that, really makes this product stand out above a lot of the other engines for searching for trips. Mashing up things like events with a calendar, with a map, with tagging, all those sort of things are things you can do to kind of create interesting relationships. Zimber did this a long time back. We now have something called Yahoo Shortcuts where contextual information is embedded. It discovers it right in the mail and allows you to look at a map of an address or look at your calendar, all those sort of things right there in place without going somewhere else. That's today, and so you can see what's on your calendar today just by hovering over that. And I'll skip this one just in interest of time because we're just at the end. So I can sum that up with thinking in objects and tying information interactivity. So this is really the way I kind of think about richness is around interaction, feedback, and information. And preferring direct, lightweight, in-page interaction, invitations beforehand, transitions during and after the interaction, and then thinking in objects and being able to tie that information to interactivity. These are just some of the principles, and these again, tie around richness and interactivity. There are plenty more design principles you can employ around visual stuff to actually reinforce things that I chose not to put in this talk. So I think I have 12 minutes left. and I can open it up for questions and get your comments if anybody has questions. All right, I got one here and then I got one here. Okay.
You start your career as a game designer. Mm-hmm. As there is lots of sounds used in the game interfaces, why don't we use sounds in the web interfaces?
Why don't we use what in the game interfaces?
Why don't we use
sounds
in web interfaces? Does it make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. In fact, Joy Monford, who is at Yahoo, used to be at Apple, and she was in charge of the Sonic Finder project, which is about taking natural sounds and blending those into, you know, the Finder interface, which didn't make much of a light of day. And we've had lots of conversations within Yahoo around that. And we've had some Hack Day experiments where what we did was we let you have your own startup sound, you know, on your Yahoo page, as well as, you know, you can see your baby's pictures and clips or whatever else and stuff like that. Those will probably eventually make it out into the eco space. And then what we're working towards, though, at Yahoo, for example, is having a centralized, more profile management, preference management. Once we have that in place, we can allow you to say, I want sounds, I don't want sounds, even things like maybe I don't want animation, you know, depending on what you're doing. And then we can bring those in without being annoying, you know, because if you bring the sounds in the web, it can, especially with tabbed interfaces, because you have like 5 tabs up, and all of a sudden one of those tabs is playing some hideous background music, you're going, where'd that come from, you know, and you forgot that somebody sent you a link to something you clicked on, you know. Right. But yeah, I think they can enhance it. In fact, Scott Schiller, who did the Yahoo Photos things now at Flickr, doing the Flickr project, he has a library for Ajax. It actually pulls Flash into it, uses it for the player to bring sound in. And there's actually some technically you can do that now. But I think it makes sense. Yeah. You had a question too?
Yeah. All my web, it just seems like a tragedy. This new interface.
Yeah. So the question was about all the web, and it's a shame that kind of got backyarded. The designers, I know the designers and the engineers who worked on it. In fact, one of the guys is coming over to my team on teachers. We were having a little cry party about that because we thought the same thing. It's really a hard problem to solve because, you know, what you're doing is you are hitting the back end more often, and there's not much you can do about that. It's not really any way to cache that stuff because it's dynamic searching. So it's pretty much right now until, you know, over time maybe it becomes more of a business case to do it, and servers get, you know, the old hardware gets cheaper and cheaper, and you have these big farms, and maybe you can do it. Yeah,
what's
I agree.
The source of performance? Is it disk or cycles on the server?
It's actually the multiple requests going back and pulling the search results back, so you're actually having the engines go out and do all the search through the index, and that's a lot of load on the servers each time, because what you're doing is you're typing and you're getting back a set of results, and then you type some more, you get another set of results, you type some more, you get another set of results, and so you're like getting many fold times the number of search queries than you would the traditional interface for no real, you know, economic payback. So, yes?
Can you say something about the conceptualizing these type of interfaces? You said earlier on that the wireframes sort of led to page-based type of interfaces.
Yeah.
So during the design process, when you're conceptualizing these type of interfaces, what would you recommend? Can you say something about that?
Yeah, how do you conceptualize? That's a really hard problem because there's not. It appears now in your space, in the Silverlight space, that there's going to be some better ways to prototype and stuff like that, because it sort of blends the prototyping and coding together. I do know of a couple of companies that are coming out with strictly conceptual prototyping tools that really focus on the conceptual phase, sort of like a SketchUp, if you will, concept, if you're familiar with SketchUp. It allows a much more lightweight process of that throwaway environment. I mean, when I've done a number of things, you can look on my blog that's somewhere up there, looksgoodworkswell.com. I've done a Visio thing where I made Visio interactive so that by putting things in layers, I could associate with different storyboard steps, and you can actually get sort of a flow of what's going to happen in the interface. I've done things with Photoshop. I've done things with the animation palette and creating animated GIFs to sort of illustrate different micro techniques. I have something also on my blog about it's called interesting moments grid. It gives you a kind of a static way on paper to document things like drag and drop and line editing that are more dense. Everybody uses different tools. So what I would say is that wireframes still make a lot of sense. And what happens is then you have basically tie-ins or call-outs where you either use a kind of a timeline approach where you sort of put things in a storyboard sequence on the page, or you create an animated GIF that then you share. And the problem is that it doesn't print well, right? You know, so that's, you know, some of the issues you run into. So there's no real one answer to it. There's like dozens and dozens of. In fact, I'm going to be doing a talk, a couple of talks this summer about prototyping with Ajax, and I'm building a library on the side that makes it a lot easier for non-engineers to actually prototype with Ajax, layering on top of a number of the Ajax libraries, not reinventing all that, but focusing really on prototyping. Any other questions? I think we have a few more minutes. Yes. How do you track page hits now that we have Ajax? So we have this thing called universal link tracking within Yahoo that's been based on, you know, link clicking. And we've actually are adding new mechanisms in so we can track some of that. The sad truth is we don't track a lot of the stuff. For example, on the Yahoo News, when you do the hover, we don't know really how many times people have hovered over those things versus actually clicking through. We should, but the problem is that, and that was some of the role in the Ajax evangelism role, is to educate all these different groups within Yahoo. Because you have a group that builds, say, advertising or builds the link tracking. Well, they're not doing front-end development. So it takes them a while to fully understand the impact, fully get their head around the technology, and get some kind of engagement where you have them doing it. Different companies, it's not that hard to do, though. I mean, because but you have to kind of balance it. Do you do it in a kind of a bucket testing mechanism where you don't load the whole system down with it, you just do it at different, you know, places and sort of get a statistical kind of analysis about how many people are doing these sort of interactions. That's probably a more appropriate approach because you're adding a chattiness to the application for this kind of metrics gathering, and that's probably the best approach. Yeah. So ASP.NET has a view state. I'm not too familiar with that, so can you elaborate? Right, okay, so it contains the state of all the controls on the page. Well, I mean, Yahoo has a number of different techniques. Yahoo's like a whole bunch of companies all slammed together. I mean, we have this thing called Space ID, which in essence, every page has a unique ID. And then with the link tracking, though, we actually embed some information in that link tracking, which we're simplifying now because these URLs are long. If you ever look at Yahoo search, they've got these hideous URLs you can't actually bookmark, which is crappy. So we're going to change that, and we'll do something more along that line so that we can pass that stuff along. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I think unless there's another question. Yeah, one back here.
You mentioned with drag and drop that one of the challenges is discoverability.
Yeah.
And then you gave the example of the site kind of hit users over the head with the word drag.
Yeah.
Do you have any best practices for discoverability of drag and drop?
That is a hard one. We're wrestling with on our teacher site because we have a lot of stuff you can actually drag and drop. And the way we're solving that, which is kind of crappy, but I don't know any other way to do it right now, is for those key interactions like that, we have a quick kind of animated GIF that sort of shows that happening to let them know you can do that. That's really, I think, bad, but that's what we're working on. We've done a number of studies with, like on MyYahoo, we brought users in to see how they could discover drag and drop. And we found that a lot of users, if they knew drag and drop existed, if the cursor changed, especially the hand, but most browsers want to do that little crosshair thing for the move cursor, then they would know that would do that. That's where they could drag it. And so they need a little bit of a hint that you can drag and drop. Another way to do it is if in their interface you can make things look like objects that can be moved around, you know, give them more of a relief. And then, of course, the cursor changes. And then, you know, you can have a tooltip that says drag to do whatever. You know, that's one of the things. As soon as you start to drag it, you can do all sorts of things. Like you can actually do a query to the back end and find what's valid to drag into, if you need to kind of state information or if you already know on the page, and you can light those possible choices up. You can even do a drag and come to me kind of drop thing where you bring things close in and let, you know, drop. So there's a ton of things once you start dragging to make it simple. It's that discovery of drag that's really kind of challenging. In fact, on my Yahoo, we still have the change layout link at the top, which actually draws people to the old way to do it, the non-drag drop way, which I'm convinced keeps a lot of people from ever discovering that we have drag drop. We should have on that page, did you know you could drag drop, blah, 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 you know, and explain that to them, right? We don't have that right now. So, yep, one more question. Say it again. Well, so if you're doing pure Ajax stuff, not in the Atlas, you know, kind of Microsoft world, right? I'm obviously pretty biased towards Yahoo User Interface Library, YUI, having worked on it a little bit, so that would probably bias me. I liked Rico because it was real simple, but Rico's not full-featured, and I wouldn't recommend it at this point, even though they're doing a Rico 2.0. Scriptaculous and the Ruby on Rails stuff is really great. The YUI library has really gotten to be very sound and robust. We use it for almost everything within Yahoo now. In fact, any new project goes to it. So we're concerned about scalability. We're concerned about page weight. If you haven't read the yuiblog.com, you should read that. Subscribe to that, yuiblog.com. We talk about not just our libraries. We have tons of video theaters on there where we have different speakers come into Yahoo and give talks on the front-end development. Lots of really great, like the guys who did Firebug and all this sort of things like that. And we talk a lot about the page weight problem and performance and those sort of things. So just check that out. Our library is free. There's no charge for it. It's Berkeley licensed. You can use any way you want to it. Same thing with Scriptaculous and the Rails stuff. Oh, I love it. I love it. Yeah, I really do. I really do like it a lot. And those guys are absolutely awesome that's on that team. There's about 8 guys that are on the team dedicated full-time just to doing that. So we don't see it as a fly-by-night operation. We're really committed to making that. And the good thing about the YUI library, continue to plug, I'm sorry, is that it has a lot of good documentation. It has lots of good documentation. It's the best documented open source Ajax framework out there, not counting Atlas, because I'm sure Microsoft will have tons of documentation for that, but I'm saying it really is solid that way. And I'm exactly out of time right now. Thank you for your attention. Appreciate it.